Ronan O'Gara talks about joining the Ireland coaching staff. What does the future hold for Joey Carberry? And why England legend Martin Johnson wasn't allowed to talk to referees? It's all coming up in The Hard Yards.
The Hard Yards, brought to you by Ladbrokes, passionate about sport.
With fantastic support, half of Ireland were here. The rest of them are hopefully smiling at home.
We had a bet earlier in the year, €20, that if we won it, I wouldn't cry, but it's the best £20 I'll ever spend.
Here's Heaslip. Well, he picks it up quickly and off he goes. Drops it off to Hinshaw. Robbie Hinshaw scores it. Rugby history. Ireland beat the All Blacks for the first time.
Hello and welcome to episode 10 of The Hard Yards, the Sports Show Rugby podcast. I'm Andy McGeady. With me in studio is Ronan O'Gara. On the line I have Jordan Murphy. And beside me here is Sports Show Rugby reporter Pat McCarry. Hello, gentlemen.
Hey, Andy.
And we'll have Hayley O'Connor from Ladbrokes here later to talk about Leinster and Munster's odds to win the Champions Cup, as well as the weekend's Grand National for extracurricular activities. But first, Rog, there was a video online today about kicking practice over at Racing. Who was involved in that now?
All the backs, obviously. You have a big smile on your face, but I think in the professional game it's important that the backs can kick, so it would be... I wouldn't say an integral part of the week, but when you have a long week this week, we have a Sunday game, so you kind of get an extra day's work. So we had a walk through Monday. Tuesday was intense, and today was just separate forwards working on their game. Backs had a kind of a skill session. The skill today was basically kicking, followed by a little bit of centre passing, and back three did high ball reception. So we had 16 backs, which is good because it works in pairs, and I get to watch as opposed to kick. So,
out of interest, what's the variance in terms of ability of your backs, your 16 backs, and their ability to kick a ball?
It's hilarious because we have Fijians, Joe Rococo. It's probably the only skill he probably struggles with. But then you look at what he did last year in the final against Toulon when he dribbled up the sideline and picked it up and ran in for a try. So you never know when you need it, and that's the beauty of it. And it's funny though, because the training ground is quite windy, so you just kind of, you as you can see from the video, you just put down 5 meter corridors across the pitch, but the lads are spraying them everywhere. And you play off the kind of white tee, the red tees, the women tees, the blue tees are the professional tees, and the white tees are men's tees. So it's basically about 18 yards, 25 yards and 35 yards.
And just hitting the guy.
Yeah, but hitting the channel, but it sounds easy, but putting it into practice, it's a good skill exercise. It's enjoyable. I think the lads get a bit of it's a complete break away from the normal routine of a week. And you forget sometimes that professional rugby players were all kids, and you like doing something different, and when kicking comes in, it seems to excite them.
Jordan, do you have any drills like that, which are basically a children's game for a lot of large blokes?
Yeah, no, the very same as Rog. You know, it's a base level skill that everyone needs to practice. Unfortunately, as he said, you get a lot of South Sea Islanders who have been raised running the ball and not kicking it. So you get quite amusing results when you do play. We play actually a lot of 2v2 tennis, so very similar. We mark a court out and we just sort of play like that, and we sort of play one game. The winner of the game moves up the court, and at the end of the day, we have a king of the court type thing. So we mark it out. And it's the very same principles. You just do it in twos. You can do it in threes. And a little bit of competition added into puts the guys under pressure. I try to put them under pressure for time as well, so they catch it, give them 3 seconds to get it out of their hands. So they're kicking it. So it's obviously a repping, you know, being under pressure in a game. But yeah, again, sort of base level skill stuff that we presume every team across the world is doing.
You were known for being a fairly skillful player now when you were playing. But when you were training, did they take the time to do these kind of drills back when you were playing?
Yeah, very much so. I think one of the things that I've always sort of believed in is that, like, good players always sort of do extras. And you'd always see, like, I think, you know, Johnny Wilkinson, Ronan O'Gara, the guys, they'd always be first on the training field, touching up on those skills, doing a little bit of kicking. And then at the end of the session, you know, we'd always... whenever I played in 19 with Rog, you'd always stay behind, and you know, if you didn't get your opportunity to kick in the session, you'd kick at the end of the session, and that's obviously guys who are dedicated. I think Rog, I was actually curious to ask him there as he was going, are there any guys in the squad that can kick as well as he can still to this day? If you took any of them on a one-on-one, Roger, would they beat you?
Well, I think James Hart posted a video from Lille last weekend. I took him on in a kicking competition. He kicked 9 out of 9 and I kicked 8 out of 9, and the one kick I missed, he put up an Instagram, I believe, a video in slow motion. So
it's,
I look forward.
It's obviously... Yeah, you see, it's a good thing if they're putting up the one thing, one kick that you miss.
No, but no one has a clue. Everyone just presumes I took one and missed one. So, but it's, you're right, Jordy. It's a fascinating subject because, as you say, trying to get them to work under pressure, they don't really get that. So everyone was kicking in the fixed position, while the only person that kicks in a fixed position nowadays would be obviously the fella kicking to touch. But the idea of catching the ball, assembling your thoughts and your body shape to get it going and within 3 seconds just doesn't happen, especially on a Wednesday morning when it's the first thing you're doing. So some people would take 15 seconds to get their head around kicking the ball. Others were just spraying them off the inside. So we kind of tried to do 4 endeavour ends, 2 drops and 2 spirals. Mm. So between them, you and your partners, 4 kicks each. But it takes a fair bit of time to get to the 8 successful kicks.
How much extra training would you have done now during your career? As in the daily routine? You're
out looked upon it as extra training. For me, it was training.
That's the interview answer right there. Yeah.
Because I've been talking about this for a long time, and Jordy would have played with a lot of these guys. The 2001 Lions tour that I went on opened my eyes to what work rate was, and it was Neil Back, Martin Johnson, all the players were from the Leicester background, Austin Healy, people that were way ahead, and 2 years later they went on to win the World Cup. So Jordy was part of that environment all of his career, so he got to see what it was like. But for me, that was just a massive massive acceleration in terms of what was needed, what was required. It wasn't, I never looked upon it as extras, but we would have done a lot in Irish camp too with backs, with Jordy, myself, Garvin Dempsey, Dennis Hickey, Brian, scrum halves, even Kevin Maggs had an old swipe or two at it. So I think Maggsy would convince you he'd put it in the corner. All right, Jordy. I was like, Maggsy, you just crashed that up, don't worry about phase two.
But it wasn't extra training, but like you're there, it can be a lonely thing if you're around afterwards.
Not, I mean, lonely if you love it though.
Okay.
I think if people don't get it, actually tiring, or kicking is very tiring.
Yeah.
Because I think what people don't get is you try and, as Jordy said, put yourself in the mat situation. So catch, kick. But if you catch the ball and kick the ball, that takes probably 10 steps. Then you have to backpedal 10 steps. And if you're plugging a 5 metre channel and you've a fella like Jordy 40 yards away, you get a great game going. You get great intensity. We used to kick across Lansdowne Road, and I can remember Jordy in the middle of November. It was horrendous. You wouldn't put a dog out in it. But we still did it on our Wednesday, and that was our day off. And then you kind of, you know, whatever way your head works, you just cannot wait for the toasted sandwich and chips and the hot chocolate afterwards just to warm up. But that was kind of your reward for going out and kicking in the snow.
Right. This is an interesting day because there are reports about the summer tour and the coaching lineup to the USA and Japan with Ireland. Rog, what's the story there? Are you going on the tour?
I'm going for the American leg. Okay. Felix Jones is going for the Japanese first or second test, and Garvin Dempsey as well. So basically Andy Farrell is gone with the Lions. I think they're down a coach, so there's 3 of us obviously trying to have a look under the tutelage of Joe Smith to see how he operates, and it'll be a wonderful learning experience. I don't think there's any official role except skills coach and offer advice to younger players, and so it's a role that's hugely interesting, and cannot wait to get involved.
How does something like that come about? Is it a phone call? Is it
what you mean in terms of,
as in, is this something that you've been chatting to Joe or the IRFU about for a
no,
while?
No, not at all. No, I've been in contact obviously with Joe since ever since Johnny was in the club, I would regularly discuss rugby with him. You could talk to him a few times a week and then you mightn't talk to him for months, but if I was struggling on an area of the game that I didn't understand, he'd be one of the first people I'd ring and ask his opinion on. He watches rugby all around the world, so he knows exactly what you would be talking about. He's interested in the top 14 as well. So I obviously have James Hart in the club at the minute. Chris Farrell is in Grenoble, so he'd be kind of just, he has a, I suppose, a big desire to see how his Irish players are faring, and I think the report from the media is very different to the report of a person on the ground, so you'd be previewing, reviewing games, and he'd ask your opinion on one or two things. And then I was obviously keen to see how he operates, so if an opportunity came up, I just said, Joe, if anything was coming into camp for a week was available, I'd be interested.
So the opportunity has come up. You've said yes.
I most definitely have said yes, yeah.
Jordan, there's been a bit of upheaval over in Leicester at the moment as well. Between Leicester and Toulon, there's a lot of swapping going on. What is the current situation? Matt O'Connor's in. You're still there in the assistant coaching setup?
Yeah, very much so. I think when you say a slight upheaval, it's probably the biggest amount of upheaval I've experienced in 20 years of professional rugby. We've lost three coaches this season. Started the season sort of 3 months in, we lost our defence coach. We lost Richard Cockrell, obviously, who went to Toulon, and obviously this week he's been made the head man there. But he's gone back to Edinburgh at the end of the season, and then Aaron Major was replaced by Matt O'Connor, who's just actually arrived in today. So he's actually landed about 2 hours ago in Leicester. When you say upheaval, it's been a crazy season. Obviously, you know, our performances haven't been fantastic, but in saying that, you know, we've been competitive at times. We've managed to get ourselves into the top four, which is obviously something that we've been for the last sort of 13 or 14 years. So the standards are pretty high here, and the fans' expectation is high, and the board are riding our case pretty hard. So at the moment I'm still contracted. I've got another year on my contract. I'm sort of talking to them about extending at the moment as well. They seem to be okay, although I suppose contracts in Leicester don't really seem to be worth the paper they're written on at the moment. It's been a hell of a season for me, really. A hell of a learning curve in that I've had opportunity to lead the team on quite a few occasions, and have been doing so for the last couple of weeks since Aaron Major left as well. So
what does losing three coaches in a season like that from the team, what does that do to a club in terms of the day-to-day? Players like you are picking up the pieces a bit.
The players, actually, I suppose that's pretty much where it's all at. The players have been, you know, full credit to them. They've been brilliant. Obviously, it's a little bit, it's a huge distraction. It's not a little bit of a distraction. It's massive. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of media interest in around, and people want to know the reasons why. And, you know, sometimes it's not as simple as you know, ABC, you know, the board make decisions on you know, what they think and what they see as well. So it is particularly tough. But in saying that, you know, from my point of view, I think the players have been golden, you know, just with the way they've fronted up and they sort of, they've, you know, redoubled their efforts at times. And at stages, you know, we've been really unlucky with injuries. And I think some of that, you know, we've played in some big games with some very young players and some inexperienced players. And obviously we've paid the price for that. But you know, I suppose, you know, there's no excuses. We you know, have to take responsibility for our own performances, and hopefully, you know, they'll pick up in the next few weeks.
Right, let's move on to something different. There was a fantastic performance by one Leinster player at the weekend that I know I came away from the Aviva Stadium chatting to everyone about, Joey Carberry. So we have one of the, well, I think one of the great attacking fullbacks in the line. So Jordan Murphy, what do you think of young Joey Carberry, and is that the kind of player you'd love to get your coaching hands on?
Yeah, very much so. He's a tremendous talent. Obviously, you know, I've seen him play a lot at 10. It was the first time I've seen him have a run at fullback. But what can you say? I thought he played fantastically well. You know, his pass for Nassi was Troy was just quality. You know, he didn't really have any worry about the intercept, and Christian Wade on that side of the field would, you know, be known for picking those off. But just he read the body language of the two defenders in front of him perfectly, and I think one of the things you get with players like that, obviously, if you've got a player like Johnny Sexton on the field, you get a second pivot, a second pair of hands, and then a second boot. So, you know, I was really impressed with him on the weekend.
It is funny, that pass, we've seen some other players come in and do that. Simon Zebo's done it a couple of times. having that second playmaker, is it something that every team should have, or is it just, is it a luxury?
Yeah, no, I think obviously in the Southern Hemisphere, it's something that they look to do consistently. You know, they call their 12 second 5/8s. They have their first 5/8 and their second 5/8, and that's what they look for. They look for that second set of hands. In the Northern Hemisphere, I suppose, mainly due to conditions and possibly due to the way that, you know, we've played for a long time, that 12 has been more of a first centre of a, you know, physical body to a, you know, on occasion when the weather's not good, just to hit it up, Magsy-esque, get his tin hat on and run straight up and down on the rails. So it depends really on how you want to play the game. You know, it's a nice option to have if you've got a ball playing second receiver to take your pressure off your 10. I think that's fantastic. You know, I think Ronan, obviously having played at 10, he'll tell you how much every team talks about focusing on targeting the opposition 10. You want to target them, you want to put them under as much pressure, because they're the general, they're the guys, you know, pushing the team around the field. So to have a guy outside of that just calling the ball out of his hands, a second set of eyes, a second set of hands that you can trust, and, you know, as a first receiver, as a 10, that you can just say, well, I'm just going to put it in his hands every time he calls for it, and you trust him to make the right decision, obviously makes it a lot easier for your 10 to run a game as well, I think.
So, Rog, I mean, did you enjoy playing with a player who either at 12 or at 15 could actually come in? And
yeah, absolutely. But I think it's been there for a long time. I think it's all the rage after the weekend because obviously the way, I suppose, Munster dismantled Toulouse on a fine day for rugby and Leinster destroyed Wasp. But it was always there. I think if you go back 10, 15 years, it was... Dars had the capacity to play both roles. Brian O'Driscoll was a second receiver. Jordan Murphy was a second receiver. In the red jersey for me, Lefemi Mafi was a brilliant second receiver. Tupoki was a second receiver. If Trevor Halstead was in the team, there was another way of winning a game. So it all depended about who you had and how best to use them. Rob Henderson wasn't a second receiver, but he was really effective as a first centre. But then you could just play maybe a channel wider. So I think... teams have always done that, and as Jordy said, you've 7 months of the year over here that are probably wet and it's not suited to doing that, so you kind of play off your first receiver. But now when the cups are decided, you have fine weather, but that's probably a 2 month period. You have to do the hard yards before that, and I think, excuse the pun,
no, that's perfect, we're going to use that now. Big promo now,
soundbite.
He's on brand here.
There's McGarry, yeah. There, I'm on a bonus for that, definitely. Yeah. Get
Jordy,
that
if
in,
if you want to get in the hard yards at any stage as well, feel free.
And that wasn't staged either, or you're distracting me, lads. I'm losing my train of thought here. Hold on.
So I'll bring you back this. Look, we've always had creative players, right? And there's always been a place for the second playmaker in rugby, or whatever you want to call them. But in Ireland, are we actually good at handling players like that? So example, Joey Carby's coming through now. Simon Zebo, for a long time, would have been thought of maybe the Irish level as a wild card rather than a playmaker. And I'm making that distinction. Someone like JJ Hanrahan went away. Jeremy Staunton, was that a player that was used well by Irish teams? Do you know the thread I'm going on here?
I do, but I don't think your argument is stacking up, because I think you look at, like, look how well Carberry has flourished. Carberry was playing AIL last year. Look at his graph cannot continue to project like that. He's got to the top now nearly. He obviously has to do that consistently. What will happen in the next 12 months is he'll become analysed. His game will slow down, most definitely, because he's a danger every time he gets the ball. What happens when you're a danger every time? You don't get one person on you, you'll have three people looking at him.
Yeah, Joe Simpson caught him pretty badly in that one incident, all right.
You look at that, Simon Zebo has the X factor. Simon Zebo plays, but Simon Zebo is a great talent. I think Jordy would know more about it, but he's a serious player. I don't think his career has stalled one bit. Jeremy Staunton was different in terms that he could do absolute... magical things with a ball, but could he do it consistently? Probably yes, but then he had probably me competing for the same jersey and I wasn't prepared to let him in there, which became difficult. JJ Hanrahan showed glimpses for Munster, went to Northampton, hasn't showed glimpses. He is about to kickstart his career. So I think Jordy Murphy could do unbelievable things with the ball, but Jordy Murphy has had a magnificent career and I wouldn't say he has any regrets. So I think in terms of are we I think that just for me, projects that we've a negativity in this country towards geniuses. I don't think so. I think you asked Jordy, always the best players get on the pitch because the best players want to play with the best players. It's the same in Leinster. You asked Sean O'Brien 12 months ago, he said, yeah, Carberry's the man, he'll play because players want him on the pitch. But after a while he'll become analysed. He's in the honeymoon period. There'll be another 24 months where he'll find his feet, and then hopefully he'll kick on again.
So, Jordan, I mean, Roger mentioned there, like, you had a magnificent career, but it was away from Ireland. Looking back to Ireland, am I talking through my backside, or do I have anything here that says that perhaps Ireland's use of creative players hasn't been as good as it could have been over the years?
No, I'm with Roger on this. I think, obviously, you know, the cream will always rise to the top. It's a really difficult one. I think, obviously, for me, was a 10, came through as a 10 and found himself on the weekend. You know, he's obviously... the players want him on the field, so he found himself out there at 15 and did a really good job. Obviously, to back that up week in, week out, if he's going to play 15, as Rod said, you know, there'll be people analysing him, there'll be people having a crack at him in different ways, and you know, it's up to Joey to see how he cracks on from here. No one would argue he's a fantastic talent. He can play ball, he can kick the ball, he can pass the ball, he can see the game, and it's just about him doing that consistently. Like, you know, from my point of view, for a long time in my career, it was, you know, if I didn't move home, I wasn't going to get picked to play for Ireland. Well, certainly for a few years, and you know, it was always the case where, for whatever reason, I was tied into contracts, or I was, you know, really enjoying my rugby here, but you know, managed to get out and put on the Irish shirt 72 times, which was, you know, obviously a dream. So as Rod said, you know, you if you're good enough and you're playing well enough, you'll manage to get yourself into the team.
So Carberry is the guy who was all over the papers and all over the media, and has been mentioned a lot in this podcast so far. There are other players who perhaps are as important to teams. Duncan Williams was a guy who was very important to Munster last weekend. Came in at short notice for Conor Murray, and described as a player's player. Roger, I mean, you were around the Munster setup for a huge length of time. Do you see players there who stay around for a long, long time, perhaps more than their pure skills would actually... that sounds a bit harsh, but... that are guys who people want are in the squad, who will come in and always do a job.
Yeah, and I think you've highlighted a very important point. I think Duncan Williams has been very patient, but he was probably pushed to the brink of being nearly extinct, but mentally he kept in there, and I think he got a big reward in terms of standing ovation when he came off with 7 minutes to go against Toulouse. And for him, his game will kick on to another level because he hasn't had the taste of what real confidence is, because he's been berated and slated on social media and by everyone. But I think, you know, I've always been a big fan of Duncan Williams because I've trained with him for 5 years. I know what he brings to the changing room. I know what he brings to the gym. I know what he brings to the whole setup. And I think you have to be patient. Billy Holland would be another example of that profile of player. Billy's capped for Ireland now and kicking on in the second round. I think it was lovely to see his teammates come out and back him, because Duncan is hard and he's tough and he's wiry, but he puts his body on the line every time. And I think he's 29 now, and he's waited a long time for his day in the sun, but it's great that he did get a day in the sun.
Oh, so something like that fascinates me, and I think it's amazing. And obviously, we touched on it. Like, you know, for a guy like Duncan Williams, the reason he's a player's player is because he goes and he brings it every day. He knows that in a big game, if everyone's fit, Conor Murray's going to start. You know, Conor Murray's Irish. He's quality. He's the starting nine. That's sort of his role that he has to fulfil. But there, Rod, you know, saying it, he's bringing it every day. He's pushing him all the way. He's doing all his best with a view to when he does get his opportunity, he's going to put in a performance like he did on the weekend. And I think that's why players obviously respect guys like that. You know, for me, obviously, with only the four provinces in Ireland, I've seen a huge amount of guys come through and obviously sit in that role behind guys like Rog, you know, as you said about Jeremy Staunton, behind Darcy, behind O'Driscoll. I see a huge amount of talent coming through at a young age, and guys, you know, just happy, not happy because they want to push themselves on, you know, but they sit there, I suppose, but you know, they just get the opportunities in that, you know, the big stage, the big occasions. We're probably going to go for the tried and tested, and you know, the world class players that they have in the provinces. So, I love to see, you know, guys like Duncan Williams have a game like they did on the weekend.
There was a moment at the start of that game where Francois Croix just went for him at the start, because he knew he would have been targeted at the very start, and he got absolutely flaked out of it. And in the end Quah got the yellow card for himself, but Williams just hopped straight back up and he just couldn't show anybody that he was hurting, and he went on, play went on for around 90 seconds, and then when there was a break in play you just seen him crouch down and you knew it hurt, but like that would have meant a lot to the teammates as well, and just to kind of show like you're not going to kind of push me around as well, and it just showed you how stupid Toulouse were as well, coming out the start of the game and doing that.
Especially Cross, I think, yeah, completely just was taken by the occasion.
Yeah, he was wired the whole game, yeah.
It could have been a red card.
It was not the most subtle foul you've ever seen in a rugby
pitch.
No,
when you examine it on the TMO.
Yeah, worse every second.
Exactly.
Yeah. The all this was part of what was a magnificent Saturday for Irish rugby. There's been a few years where the Irish teams have not been at the top table for European rugby. We've now got Leinster and Munster right back up there. But is this, like, how do these teams stack up to Saracens and Clermont, who they will play in a few weeks? Are they really back at the top table here? Jordan, from your position, what do you see going on here?
Yeah, you know, I don't think you can read a huge amount into it. You know, I think last year before, everything was doom and gloom because at this stage, you know, the performances probably just weren't there, a little bit off, and everyone said, oh, you know, Irish rugby is in the pits. And the flip side of that now, obviously, two teams in the semi-finals, everyone's saying, oh, isn't everything great? I think, you know, Irish rugby is in a very strong position. I think, you know, there's some absolute world-class players in both squads. Two very tough games ahead, really, to be quite honest, because I think, obviously, Clermont will be very, very difficult. I suppose they're not at home in the Stade Michelin. They'll be down the road in I'm not sure, where is that game? That's in...
Lyon, yeah.
Yeah, Lyon.
Lyon, which will be interesting. And Munster are obviously have a tough one at home to Saracens. But, you know, I think it'll be very interesting. I'm looking forward to those games. I wouldn't want to pin them out. I think Munster can they get a home win. I think Leinster will struggle abroad in Clermont or in Lyon.
In terms of the general thing here, Rog, of, you know, we've got two teams who've come back up and with a string of strong performances. Is this where we've got a new generation coming through that has needed a couple of years to settle into themselves as players like yourself have retired and moved on?
Well, I'm retired a long time, but yeah. I think, they're coming from two, I suppose, completely different areas, and it's a fascinating subject, particularly the Munster topic. I think you look at what they've achieved this season under the circumstances, but Razzie Erasmus has to take huge credit.
How important is it to keep him around now?
Well, it's crucial because I think he's kind of like a father figure to the players, and he seems to offer massive stability to the whole organisation, and that's exactly what Munster were crying out for, a father figure, someone to kind of, I suppose, put all their beliefs on, and he has taken on that role brilliantly. And it's a lot of the same players that were going nowhere for 2 years are now nearly unbeaten all season. And I agree with Jordan. I think sometimes it's your year, and it feels like that for Munster this year. And their season is probably epitomised by John Ryan, like how he played at the weekend for 70 minutes against massive lumps. You know, I mean, two different loose heads coming in on him. One fella obviously coming off after 49 minutes, a new guy for 21 minutes, and still not a bother on him. Still making cover tackles, still driving people back. And I think he epitomises everything good about Munster at the minute. But you look at, you know what I mean, Ronan O'Mahony wasn't in the squad last weekend. For people outside the province, they mightn't be aware of how good this guy is, but I'm fully convinced that he'll play for Ireland. I think you look at Conway was on the bench. Conway fronted up and took his game to a new level against England. Munster didn't have that in the past in terms of, I suppose, the luxury of choice and the backs and the forwards. Yes, they always have. Would I think the current pack is as good as the pack that are that won in 06 and 08? Probably not, but they have such hunger and dog and work rate in them that completely led by a brilliant Dunnick Ryan at the minute. He's playing great stuff. Last weekend I was in the ground, and just at pitch level you could see he was just so composed in terms of his calling strategy, in terms of his linking with Tyler Blinn and all, in terms of running the game. It wasn't just completely run by 10. It was interesting to watch the on-field chemistry between how the two of them went about, I suppose, choosing whether they'd peel, whether they take it off the top, whether they drive it, whether they'd go to wit, whether they'd hit the 10 channel. And you could see them having many discussions. And And Munster obviously were inaccurate at times. That's the scary thing. They weren't really, for the first
it
half.
It dropped off there for a while, didn't it, during the first half?
Yeah, I think that after 10-0 up, the result wasn't in doubt. I think Munster switched off a little bit.
Mm.
Then the crowd got into them and kind of said, come on, we want a good day out here.
Yeah.
And they came back again. And, you know what I mean, they won in second gear, really.
So you said something interesting there at the start, that this was being done in two different ways.
Yes. I always felt like the production line in Leinster is greater than any team in Europe. Obviously, the amount of young kids that are available, the academy system, the school system, the young players, and I think obviously their ability to coach the players and bring in the players. I think Leo Cullen is a lot smarter than people make him out. I think he's happy taking a back
seat. He's happier where he is this season.
But he's very, very shrewd in terms of the programme he's running. And Lancaster seems to be a highly motivated coach, as he should be, obviously, coming back from that disappointment. But they have a great mix between people who have won at the highest level consistently and a lot of hungry young players. And I think that's a big mix. But it's where they should be, I think. Obviously, the previous years, Munster were hugely underperforming. But now they've got their act together. Leinster last season completely underperforming. This season, they are that good. I probably disagree with Jordy. I think they'll win against Claremont.
Do you think Munster will win as well?
Well, I think if Munster beats Saracen, I think the winner of that game will win the European Cup.
Okay.
I just think Saracens are so good. You look at how they just demolished Glasgow, and I think Glasgow's essentially the Scottish team.
You actually, we were chatting to someone like O'Mahony, he was there at the end of the game, and he was saying that you dropped into the dressing room to have a chat to them afterwards. Was that the first time you were back in years? Like, would you have dared go back in the past?
I was back for Axel's game, but obviously it was a completely sad and
different occasion.
Yeah. And it was just, our heads were in a different place. The great thing about this weekend was I went with my three boys, because they don't know what Thomond Park is.
Yeah.
And it's important they know what Thomond Park is. And so we took a day out. We went to a Young Munster luncheon with Mike Prendergast before the game, and then into Thomond Park and had great seats. And then I was kind of, edgy about going to the change room. I went down and met Felix Jones, and he said, go on in, of course, go in. And the kids were asking, can we go to the vestiaire, because they don't know what the word for dressing room is in English. Can we go to the vestiaire? I said, of course, yeah, we'll go down. And when we went in, it was like I'd never left the place. It was fantastic. And Jerry Flannery was there, and all the medical team and the coaches and all the players. And obviously there's a new generation, and I know a big figure like me, you just you can have an intimidating presence on them, but it didn't feel like that one bit. It was really cool.
Jordy's
what are you laughing at?
I'm laughing at you talking yourself up.
Yeah. The modesty level in the room is, we'll leave it there. Right, listen, up next we'll chat about the influence that players can have over referees.
The Hard Yards on Sports Joe, backed by Ladbrokes.
Okay, and we're back. And we do hear a lot about the influence that some coaches can have over referees, with little conversations before a match or afterwards or when they see them. But players can have influence over referees too. And there was a brilliant example from this last weekend from Super Rugby, where TJ Perenara got a decision change. So I'll talk this through for anyone who didn't see it. So there's a scrum under the Reds posts. TJ Perenara is captain and scrum half for the Hurricanes. There is a penalty given by the referee, Angus Gardner, and Perenara goes for the quick tap and just dives straight over the line. And you think, this is great, try. TMO is a quick check. He never actually made contact with the ball when he tapped it. So the referee blows it up and says, sorry, no try, and he gives the scrum to the Reds. Everyone still following me?
Mm-hmm.
Perenara had gone back to the halfway line to sell.
He got the try, yeah.
Exactly. He runs all the way back, and as captain's going, what's going on? Gardner says, I will explain to you, no problem. TMO said you didn't touch the ball. Perenara then goes, but then it's still my penalty. I didn't touch the ball. I haven't taken the kick. It's my penalty still. And Curtin turns around and goes, yep, that's a fair point, and changes the decision. It was just, it was the most amazing thing I've seen in a long time, where a referee actually listens to a player change the decision. Whether he got the decision right in the end or wrong, I don't even get into. But some players over the years are very, very good at working a referee, at handling a referee. You know, players like Mick Galway had the reputation for it. Martin Johnson had the reputation for it. Paul O'Connell had the reputation for it.
Best has grown it as well, isn't he? He's brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, is this how important is that in a game? How much can a referee be influenced by
think
players?
Every situation is very different. I think in terms of the Perenara case, I watched the game live, and in fairness to the referee, he said, you actually make a good point.
He did.
And he was more than happy to go back on his decision, which is great to see that the ref wasn't stubborn, or his officials. They were saying, yeah, actually, this guy knows about the laws of the game, because Jordy and myself will know the laws of the game now. There's a 400 or 500 page book from World Rugby every year, so it's become so technical. But in terms of playing the referee, it has always been there. People forget that he's human, and there's a way of managing him, and they can drive you around the bend at times, but the best of the best were always capable of keeping their composure and playing them to their team's advantage.
So how do you do that? How do you work a ref?
I think you have to know them. You have to, I know of certain test nations that have studied up on referees that they're going to have at the weekend, found out what their interests are, found out what their wife is interested, their kids' names, and all of a sudden when they meet them on the Friday lunchtime, they deliver this wham, 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 I suppose a flurry of information, and the referee is like, wow, what has this happened? And all of a sudden you paint a positive picture. And I think on the pitch, I suppose there's a way of talking to them, there's timing and talking to them. You'll know too, because all the teams, on your Thursday or Friday morning meeting, we get a ref presentation if you're playing test matches. This is what he's hot on, this is what he doesn't like, do not go near this. And but that's all well and good when it's presented on a Thursday morning and there's steam isn't coming out of your ears and there's no your heart isn't going 190 beats per minute. So I think it's a fascinating subject. I think over the years our best relationships in a red jersey were with Nigel Owens. I think he was very easy to play under in Thomond Park. Maybe the team was going well, but he had a very, I suppose, easy manner about himself.
And would you ever have gone to him, or would you leave it to the captain? Like a quiet word? Or
no, well, I had to work on myself and keep my mouth shut, to be honest.
There's no laughs from Jordy that time.
No, because he knows it's true. I think it's because you just, it's sometimes it pops out and you're like, oh, sorry ref, I didn't mean that. You know what I mean? People have a habit of reffing the game when they're in the game, and you can't do that. Drives the ref demented. So after a while, you get feedback from your players, you get feedback from the coaches, you get feedback from the referees beforehand. You just, and if they say to you, well, you keep it down today, you keep it down. But there was really good players and captains. Brian O'Driscoll had a great manner in terms of how he dealt with referees at international level. And he was far away from the action, but they still always, he wouldn't speak too often, but when he needed to speak, they'd really heed what he had to say.
Who was the best you played with at just managing a ref during the game?
Well, see, it's different times too. I think the game was different when Golov was involved, but Golov was brilliant.
How do you mean?
Oh. He was just, his manner, I think. He'd kind of look in disbelief at sometimes, and then he'd nearly start laughing at other times. And how could you give that decision, ref? And make a joke and put the arm around him. But you were allowed to touch the refs back then, and you were allowed kind of get close to them and have a joke. The pace of the game was slower, probably. And Golov was probably out of breath most of the time too, so I was happy to take a breather.
Jordan, did Martin Johnson, I'd say his routine was slightly different than Golov. Less joking, more glaring. Is that about right?
Yeah, it's one of those things. Martin Johnson actually didn't say a huge amount to any referees. I think when England won the World Cup in 2003, They had a policy where he didn't speak to any of the referees because he was such an intimidating character, 6'7", and he looked like a Ferengi from Star Trek with his forehead. Basically, the policy they had was that Matt Dawson would speak to all the referees. So he did the toss before the game. He spoke to the referee over any matters when the referee wanted to stop the game and have the team addressed. Other than that, they said, look, Matt Dawson's going to speak to you. Obviously, he's at the referee's height, at the referee's eye level. He wasn't an imposing character. He was in the referee's ear consistently. So that was something that they did. So although, you know, Martin's always been, you know, I hear it a lot, oh, you know, he was very good at playing the referees. He actually very rarely spoke to the referees, or actually very rarely spoke on the rugby field. And like Roger's saying, you know, I think every team now, you know, will do a little bit of homework on the referees and know what their likes and, you know, where their penalties are coming from, where their tendencies to give decisions are. And we're obviously all trying to stay away from that. But I think a huge amount of it is you know, each referees are and different individuals, and it's how you treat them and how you have those rapport. So for me, the best guys at dealing with them are guys who just have a knack of dealing with people well, have a knack of knowing, well, okay, you know, there's no point in talking about this guy. This referee's actually beginning to get his back up. You know, we might as well just all just keep our mouths shut here and go away. Or if the referee's in a relaxed mood and you can read that, you can have that conversation with him and try and obviously get your point around across. But it's a very difficult thing to do, and so I suppose 9 times out of 10 there's not really a huge amount it can really backfire on you, as it did for me. And Peter Fitzgibbon, actually the Irish referee, refereed Leicester Perpignan in about 2007, and I was the captain. He'd made a couple of decisions. It was getting quite hot and heavy. He made a decision. I jogged into a ask him what a penalty was for, and he marched me 10 metres to my desperation, because I was telling him, sir, I'm the captain, I'm allowed to come and speak to you, but he didn't want to be spoken to, so marched us 10 metres, they kicked a penalty and they beat us at Welford Road. So he's still on my list.
but that's an interesting point, because let's say you're still playing and you've done that with Peter Fitzgibbon. This is a small playing pool, sorry, a small refereeing pool. You're going to have to see these either later in the season or in a couple of years' time. When do you know when to push it? Like, George, when you were captain, when did you know when, look, I really have to push this now, it's worthwhile pushing this now for this call?
Oh, I think it's obviously that the gravity of the game is important. You know, if that's a European final, it's probably worth pushing. I think on the whole, you know, rugby is a great sport in that you can have, you know, a decision like that against you. I mean, you could be furious, but after the game, you know, generally you'll speak to the referee, and although you may be upset while the game's going on, after the game, it's like, well, there's not a huge amount you can do about it now. I don't think any referee in the world of rugby goes out to make mistakes. Undoubtedly, they will make mistakes, but that's just human error. At times in games, it feels like, God, this referee, you know, he's killing us because he's making these mistakes, or, you know, he's intentionally got his back up, or we've rubbed him up the wrong way. I don't think any of the referees are like that, particularly in this day and age. I think the game's too professional. They have too much coaching. They analyse all the games post-match on a Monday together. So, you know, I think it's just one of those things that you kind of just have to say, well, you know, he made a mistake. That's fair enough. You know, people are going to make mistakes. Just let's get on with it.
Raj, Jonathan Sexton at the weekend thought there was a moment. So Willie LaRue had gone, dived over the line for Wasps. Sexton had saw that ball drop, and he was choosing his moment, and he was looking at everyone that looked as if they were an official, wanting them to go to the TMO. That was a good moment. I was in the ground, I was looking down, I was almost directly above him, and he drew everyone else's attention to it. I'd say 50,000 people thought that was a try, but one person didn't, and it seemed to flag something to the TMO and the referee. But how often can you do that violently with all the arm motions and everything?
No, well, obviously he had, as we see with hindsight, he had an extreme reason to really flag it to the referee. And I don't think, obviously, as a sportsman, you do that, because obviously it was a horrendous error that you don't see. If 999 out of 1,000 times, it's a try. But obviously from the angle Johnny was at, he could see that there was separation in the ball. So I think he would absolutely, you know, he wouldn't look well if he demanded the referee, and because of the stature of the player Johnny Sexton is, the referee would, I would say, frequently listen to him and take on board his advice. So he, just to clarify, he'd have to go and ask the TMO. But if he checked the TMO and the TMO gave it 100% the try, then Johnny loses huge credibility with the referee. He cannot open his mouth to the referee. But as a result of him being sharp and getting this call right, his respect grows in Nigel Owen's mind, and it was unbelievably well spotted.
What do you say to someone like so let's say one of your players at Racing makes a mistake like that, what can or do you say to him?
You don't say anything.
You can't?
You don't. whether it's a 15-year-old or a 35-year-old, he 100% knows what he has done wrong. That's not coaching. You get on with it. That happens. It's really unfortunate. But what is the advantage in you bollocking him out of it? Absolutely none.
Would you tell him just don't do the diving thing again, or like, is there any benefit?
I think
at all?
That's a different discussion.
Okay, so let's with the technical discussion.
I actually think then if there's no diving, it's the same of why do strikers celebrate in football? That's what it's all about, the people who score tries. And Jordy would know this a lot better than me, but like, you have to have that people, because we are, I suppose, hardcore rugby coaches, supporters, ex-players, but an awful lot of the percentage of people that are in the grounds want to be entertained. I have this discussion with family members. They go to rugby games to be entertained. They look upon it as entertainment. While I would not look upon it as entertainment, I look upon it as winning, an opportunity to get the better of your opposition. But for a lot of the people that go there, they want to be entertained. They want to see X Factor. They want to see wild dives. They want to see tries. So from that point of view, if you're a coach that bans diving, I think you're on the road to the cul-de-sac.
Jordan, do you like to see players celebrate?
I'd like to see them celebrate after they've scored. to be quite honest, you know, for me with Rog, I agree with Rog. You know, a player like Willie DeRue, I don't know how many caps he has for South Africa. He knows how to play. He knows how to score a try. He's just got a little bit of beyond himself there. For me, he's just got carried away. You could probably work on the skill of diving with him. I mean, locking the ball up two hands or locking it up in one hand and just landing it on your chest. I think he kind of got himself confused. He got so excited with the nature of the try. I think he dived, was going to put it down, which you usually see, and then he tried to place it at the same time, which... obviously you've seen the results, but we've seen that in rugby before. Like Riesemont for London Irish a few seasons ago went in with a ridiculously big dive and managed to drop the ball as well. I think sometimes on occasions it happens. I know from Wasps' point of view, I think they'll be really disappointed with that, because it was probably at a crucial time in the game, and one of the key factors in the game was respecting the ball. You know, I think all season Wasps in the Premiership have, you know, they've been scoring huge amounts of tries. They've got a huge amount of X factor in their back line, and you know, they've been scoring 5-6 tries a game, but they've also been conceding 4 or 5 tries and sort of winning games by 7 points. They beat Worcester the week before that game 40-33, and you know, they were just very loose with the ball and sort of you know, really giving opposition cheap scores. So for someone like Willie LaRue to do that early in the game, I think, you know, really dented their confidence. So from that point of view, it's really frustrating for them and for him, but yeah, there's not a huge amount you can do about it now.
Right. There speaks the top try scorer of all time for Leicester Tigers. And Jordan, we'll let you go. Thank you very much for your time. We will be back looking at a crucial weekend of Pro 12 rugby coming up, as well as the Champions Cup odds with Ladbrokes' Hayley O'Connor.
The Hard Yards on Sports Joe, backed by Ladbrokes.
We're back on the Hard Yards with a look ahead to the weekend's Pro 12 action. So we've had our Champions Cup peak weekend, but we're back in. 4 games left across the European leagues. Leinster and Munster sit top of the Pro 12. Pat McCarry, who are they facing this weekend?
Yeah, Munster got Glasgow, and it's down in Irish Independent Park down in Cork, and that's their, you know, farewell to Cork this season. And it's a shame, I suppose, because they're on such a roll that it's not going to be in Thomond, but you'd be interested to see how many of their big players. Ronan was speaking earlier about the likes of Ronan O'Mahony and lads who did well who came off the bench last week, like Jack O'Donoghue and Dave Callaghan, might get a start. And Glasgow, they're by no means safe in that sixth place, so they're going to be coming to win. But yeah, Munster are going to hope to kind of do a job from close enough, and they want a top two finish so they can get a home semi-final. So I'd kind of go for Munster to win that. And then Leinster have it would have been tougher, I'd say, away to Ospreys, but then Ospreys lost, isn't it, to Treviso recently as well.
Yeah, so I watched the second half of that. Yeah, it was like not a fluke. Yeah. Ospreys were awful.
Yeah, it was a crazy enough game. So they've went and won in the Liberty Stadium before, so you know, Leinster have a tough run in when you look at it, but I think this is a game they'll be targeting for a win. So they're playing on the Saturday, and then Munster follow up, and the night before that we have Ulster at home to Cardiff. Nick Williams is back, and he's actually in decent enough form, but Ulster have to, I think Trimble's back for them as well, which kind of,
and they have to win to stay in fourth place.
Yeah, yeah, like Ulster are looking good. Yeah, like they, but they can't afford to kind of that drop. So I can see them winning that one. And then the shame is like for Alconic now, or they look like they're all they can maybe do is scrape that last playoff place or something at this stage, because they're 10 points, 11 points far out of the Champions Cup spots. And it was funny, I was saying to someone there that they got that game back against Zebra that they got cancelled, and now they went over 5 months later and lost it. Like, so
it was a good couple of weeks for the Italian sides. Like, yeah, if we take the green tinted glasses off, Zebra beating Connacht was great.
Yeah,
but it didn't feel great last weekend.
No, and they didn't have the likes of, like, it's a shame because Marmion, like, he didn't feature that much in Six Nations, that he was still given a rest week, and O'Halloran was given a rest after being in camp as well, and they're back now. But it's almost, that was, it's a risk you take, I suppose. You can't play your big guys every week, but they really kind of fell up against it. Like, so that's, their season's almost over, and now they have the likes of Marmion and Heenan and O'Halloran and Adia Lucan's all back for them. So just playing for pride at this stage, and just kind of, you'll probably see him cut loose again and be like the Connacht. Well, Connacht of old,
fingers crossed,
or of one season
of one season ago. Yeah, we've been joined by Hayley O'Connor from Ladbrokes. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Tell us, what are they looking for from the Irish provinces for the Champions Cup? Where do you think that Leinster and rugby have a chance of winning this thing?
I spoke to the guy who set the prices for this at the start of the competition, and he was so depressed today. He was like, I gave Munster no chance. No. He said after their season last year, last season, and he said, and he didn't think, he goes, I can't believe, and says, I didn't think that Leinster would ever have the depth that they do. So as it transpires, you know, after having a great result with Ireland beating England in the Six Nations and getting a rake of cash, we now find ourselves in a situation where we can only win, this can only be a winning competition for Ladbrokes if Claremont win. And as he said, Claremont, basically, they always fall at the final hurdle, you know. Because Saracens were as big as 130 at the start of the competition, or after they won last year. They are around 15 to 8 now. Munster went out to 66 to 1, so they're at one point, so that's like shocking result for us considering they're now 3 to 1. And Leinster are actually the worst results in our book. They were as big as 25 to 1, they're now 4 to 1. So, like, you know, there was plenty of takers at 25. So he was like, you know, all three bar Claremont are losers for us.
And staying on the subject of Munster, we talked earlier on the podcast about the importance of keeping their coach Rassie Erasmus around. What is Ladbrokes' view of that?
Not quite pessimistic. Like, he's sevens on with us to leave, just with his comments about clauses in his contract. We think he's likely not going to be there by the end of 2017. If you think he is going to be there, you can back him at 9 to 2. But it's not we don't think it's good.
Okay, and something to look forward to this weekend for the Pro 12. You've got a four-team accumulator for the weekend's games for the Irish provinces.
Yeah, if you're talking about the green glasses, if you think all the four provinces are going to win, you can back them at 8 to 1 at the moment. Now that price mightn't stay, but 8 to 1, so that might be. They seem to be in fine fettle, so
it's doable. It's doable.
It is doable, yeah. You've got a copy of the Racing Post on your lap.
I do.
Yeah.
On to the importance.
What's going on?
You were boring me. No, I'm only joking. Well, the big thing of the Grand National, I won't be there, actually. For the first time in a long time, our boss said, you know, I want all the senior management working in a shop on Grand National Day. And it's actually great crack in the bookies. I haven't been there for years on Grand National Day. So I actually was in our shop in the Liberties early on today, and I was talking to a couple of the street traders about who they were backing, and they were like so hilarious. Like, the favourite is a horse called Definitely Red, well, the favourite at the moment. And they asked me, oh, you know, who's the jolly? And I said, oh, a horse called Definitely Red. And they're like, Definitely Not Bleeding Red and all this. So anyway, they were giving me their stuff. But it's mental. Like, there's 40 horses. Like, they have to jump 30 horrible fences. And it's just so, like, it's so thrilling to watch. And I'd say to anyone, really good thing to do before you watch the Grand National, there was a jockey cam of Leighton Aspel the year he won it. and it goes through the race as if you're sitting on the horse. Like, it, and it's, when you see it, it's like, it's absolutely brilliant. So I would say watch that, and it'll make you enjoy and appreciate the Grand National even more. And if you're looking for winners, I just stick a pin in it. It's so difficult to predict. I'm going to go for a horse called Cocktails at Dawn at 80 to 1, just because I've had loads of cocktails at dawn. So
that works for me. I know nothing about horses. I will go with a name every time. Right, time to wrap it up. Rowan O'Garia, thank you very much. Thank you, Jordan Murphy. Thank you, Pat McCarry. Thank you, Hayley O'Connor from Ladbrokes. Joe Harrington is our producer and Shane Dempsey is on sound. Get in touch by tweeting any of us or at sportsjoe.ie and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud or through your favourite podcast app. This has been The Hard Yards. I'm Andy McGeady. Thanks again for listening and we'll see you next week.
The Hard Yards, brought to you by Ladbrokes. Passionate about sport.